See, the problem is this computer's really big.
So you don't have the space that you used to have?
It's like twice. Look at it. It's twice the size of my tiny little netbook. That's why I love my tiny little netbook.
Yeah, but your tiny little netbook was made about 1983 and has cogs.
83.
It doesn't have a motherboard.
That little netbook in 1983, it would have blown people's minds. Like, how can you fit a computer into something the size of a purse? Oh, my God. I wish I'd had that computer in 1983.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. This is episode 66. I'm just saying, this is episode 6.
Yes.
You're saying I didn't enunciate?
No, I'm never saying.
This is episode 66.
You sound as tired as I am.
So, if we do this podcast for another, I'm sure, when do we get to 666?
Oh,
600 more podcasts.
I would die.
Well, no, we would be dead. Just 12 a month, do the maths. It's 50 years. Yeah.
I'm going to live for 50 years.
Okay.
I'm living till I'm 100 at least. I like nice round numbers, so.
Today's Patron's Choice Day.
It is.
We'll get to those abominable books in a second.
Oh, stop it.
I just thought I'd mention how wrong I was.
You were totally fucked up.
Yeah, totally.
You were like,
fucked
gone.
Up.
If you'd bet money, you'd be bankrupt.
Yes. Absolutely. So I put up a list of Man Booker on the last podcast, and I think I might have got, I got Exit West right.
And you did?
I might have said Lincoln and the Bardo, because I can't remember. I haven't actually gone back to listen to what I said. I'm pretty sure I only got 2 out of 6. I definitely didn't say 4, 3, 2, 1, because that was the one I was cringing about. Please, God, don't put it on the short list because it's 377,000 words. Guess what I'm reading right now?
Oh, no.
I'm about to...
Oh, that's the one I said I hope it does go on.
Yes. So I was punished. And as it is, it's a very entertaining read. It's got issues. But anyway...
Even though it's almost 1 million words.
No, it's 377,000 words.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said 777,000
words. No, it's 300. It's still a lot of words.
It's still a lot of words.
History of Wolves, which I really... I'm going through the list now.
Yes.
History of Wolves, which I thought was rubbish. And I think I said that as much. I might have gone meh. But it's on the list. So there you go. Exit West, which is wonderful. We spoke about it last month. Elmet by Fiona Mosley, which is I did consider, but I didn't think it would be strong enough. But I think it's a very good book. I'm actually very happy that it's on the list. So you should read it, Elmet by Fiona Mosley. You should.
I should.
You must.
I must.
Maybe. Lincoln and the Bardo, which I wasn't that keen on. I love George Saunders, but not this book. And Autumn, which I think is not Ali Smith's best work. And given it's part of a quartet, the seasons, and the next one, Winter, is coming out. Actually, it hasn't been announced, the date for Winter, but anyway, it's coming out soonish, I hope. I don't know where that point was, but I don't wonder. Well, I can only wonder whether all four books in the quartet will get nominated for a...
Is the Autumn the first one?
Yes.
Okay.
I doubt they will. But anyway, it's the first post-Brexit book.
So dare I ask... What do you think will win? Or your credibility is just completely
My credibility
gone now.
Is fucked. But
so this is really just shooting at clay pigeons.
Correct. There is. But look, no, I think Exit West will win.
You think or you hope?
I hope. look, that or Elmet, I'd be very happy with. And a few weeks ago, not on the podcast, I... put up my 10 books for the National Book Award that I thought would be long-listed. 10 books.
Right.
I didn't get a single one right. Not a single fucking book that I came up with. Now, I've been reading heavily in 2017, and I thought I had a decent chance of getting at least 5.
Yeah.
At least 5.
Not
a fucking one.
Not a one.
Now, to be fair, 3 of them had yet to be published that are on the list, although I've pre-ordered 2 of them anyway, like, Carmen.
So you hadn't read them yet?
No, because they haven't been published.
Okay.
So Jennifer Egan's Manhattan Beach. Just give me.
So why did you think they'd be on the list? If you hadn't
read
them?
No, I didn't think they'd be on the list.
Oh, I'm sorry. So 3 of the books on the list
on the
have,
list
not,
have
been
not actually
right.
been published.
I get you.
And that's common that, and the Booker does this as well, that they put books on the list that, because they get galleys, they put books on the list that have actually yet to see the light of day. I didn't get a single one. Mm. I'm now looking at the list.
Yeah.
As I said, three were have yet to be published. One of them I pre-ordered like in March, which is Carmen Maria Machado's Her Body and Other Part and Other Parties
You're
stories.
Taking this personally.
No, I am. But I've actually got that on I pre-ordered that. I knew I wanted to read that. I didn't know I was going to get nominated for a National Book Award.
Okay.
I should have guessed. No, I'm really upset. I should have guessed Jennifer Egan's Manhattan Beach. I mean, of course Manhattan Beach is going to be on there. I mean, it's just stupid of me. And I should have guessed Pachinko by, where is it? Yeah, by Min Jin Lee. I should have guessed that.
So of the books you did guess, were you listing them because you read them and really liked them? Or
no, I hadn't read all the books I put on my list. Based on hype and things I liked.
Okay.
I can't remember what my list was. It's on Twitter and I can't be bothered checking.
Hmm.
But there's it is a really, really interesting bunch of 8 women on the book, on the National Book Award list. 8 women out of 10.
And so this list gets whittled down before they announce the winner?
It'll get to 5, yes. They halve it to 5. But it's amazing that I think it's the first time it's been 8 women. A lot of more people of colour or non-white. It's really good in that sense. Only 2 blokes. Elliot Ackerman's Dark at the Crossing and Daniel Alarcon's The King is Always Above the People, which is a short story collection.
Nice.
I also had Charmaine Craig's Miss Burma on my device and I didn't think of that one. And there's a couple of books I've never heard of.
I need to let this go.
I don't know if I can because I try to keep in the loop and I'm out. Clearly not. Like, I've never heard of Carol Zaref's The Barren Island and neither has anything. I had to buy that. I bought that. It's coming in the post.
So you're going to read them all?
Yeah, of course I am.
How many have you read?
I'm reading fucking 4321 by Paul Auster. It's 900 pages long.
You're saying how many have you read of that list already?
Zero.
Zero. Okay.
Have I shouted that enough?
That's going to be fun for you.
Yeah, no, it'll be great. No, National Book Award's always very good.
And when...
the other one I should have picked was Sing Unburied Sing.
So when does the Man Booker get announced, the winner?
Sing Unburied Sing, I should have guessed that, by Jessamyn Ward.
Wait, when does the Man Booker get announced?
Oh, you're trying to get me off the topic. it happens next month.
Oh, interesting. So we'll see next month if...
17th of October.
Okay, so we might be recording just after that, so... Yes, we'll see if Exit West wins or not. Because if it doesn't, your credibility, I just don't want to hear from you about books anymore.
I think you're right. No, I can't disagree with that. I think I'm going to stop reading, frankly.
Yeah, I don't know why you're bothering. If you can't pick the winners of international prestigious book awards from among the thousands of books published every year.
Not a single one. They didn't even put... I mean, they didn't put Exit West. I put Exit West on. That was my mistake because he's not a US citizen, Mohsen Hamid. That's the problem.
For the National Book Award.
Yes. I got that wrong. That was stupidity on my part. I didn't
ignorance,
think that through.
Yeah.
Yes, ignorance.
Mm.
I thought Idaho would be on there by Emily Ruskovich.
Yeah, your credibility points are just dropping by the minute.
I'm fascinated that George Saunders isn't on there because Lincoln at the Bardo was I didn't like it, but it was hyped to the tunnels.
So, you're running the show.
Oh, yes. Okay, so we had, patron's choice.
Patron's choice.
And patrons chose lots of books.
They did.
It came down to 2 books.
Well, it came down to 1 book and then a whole bunch and we had to roll a dice.
The Fisherman was the one that got the clear.
Yes.
Which is what we're going to discuss first. And the one that we had to roll for was By Light We Knew Our Names by Anne Valenti.
Which is a collection of short stories.
Yes. Which was an interesting mix. Not of short stories. I'm saying it's an interesting mix of having a novel.
The 2 books.
Yeah. So that was good. So I thought we would start with The Langdon. Let's start with a novel. Let's be controversial.
Why is that controversial?
I don't know. Because you had it the other way around initially.
It's just what I cut and paste. I wasn't even thinking.
Okay. So The Fisherman by John Langdon. Given that I am running the show, how about you explain what the book's about?
Okay. So.
Published in 2016, I should note.
Yes, it is quite a new book. You know what? I'm going to read the back cover copy because it's early. I read this a couple of weeks ago. okay, so in upstate New York, in the woods around Woodstock, Dutchman's Creek flows out of the Ashokan Reservoir. Steep-banked, fast-moving, it offers the promise of fine fishing and of something more, a possibility too fantastic to be true. When Abe and Dan, 2 widowers who have found solace in each other's company and a shared passion for fishing, hear rumours of the creek and what might be found there, the remedy to both their losses, they dismiss it as just another fish story. Soon, though, the men find themselves drawn into a tale as deep and old as the reservoir. It's a tale of dark pacts, long-buried secrets, and a mysterious figure known as De Fisher, the fisherman. It will bring Abe and Dan face to face with all that they have lost and with the price they must pay to regain it. Which is mostly true. It's massaged a little bit for the purposes of a blurb.
So what did you think of this book?
What's the phrase? I liked it well enough. I haven't used that for a while. I liked it well enough. I didn't think it was amazing, socks blowing off, you know.
You would be different to most of the world.
I did notice that when I went back and looked at reviews that talked about transcendent and best thing ever. And it's essentially a very well-written Lovecraftian style nested story type thing. And look, it's well told. The voice is very good. The monster slash scenario at the heart of the book is, you know, genuinely imaginative, and it's not just, hey, tentacles. But I didn't love it.
I think it's taken this book for me to realise I'm done with horror, or at least a certain type
of horror. Done with horror. Literary fiction has spoiled you.
This one, the Bram Stoker.
Yeah, and I can see why.
It's interesting that Langan says at the end that he struggled to place the book because it wasn't considered horror enough. It was seen as a hybrid of literary and horror.
Which is really interesting.
Which I just completely disagree with. Not with him, as in what he describes as what happened.
But that summation. This idea.
Yeah, because...
Me too. I mean, it's a well-written book.
That's
but
it. It's an accomplished...
Not...
What it is an extremely accomplished, very well-written,
yeah,
very well put together book. But somehow that makes a book literary. It's someone who can come up with, you know, sentences that run together. Well, they're literary, aren't they?
And the odd lovely metaphor.
Correct.
And not a entirely conventional linear structure.
Someone who's willing to deal with a theme, you know?
It's funny. I had a conversation with someone just 2 weeks ago, and this person shall remain nameless, but they are a genre writer. And we had this kind of exact same conversation that the, how do I put this diplomatically, the expectations around genre fiction from a craft point of view rather than a content point of view seem to be very low in terms of experimental writing, in terms of the base quality of writing, in terms of what authors do with structure and all sorts of things. The bar does seem to be set low, and that the comment by Langan at the back of this book seems to bear that out as well. That this book, which, as we said, it's very well written.
It's polished. It's a really good piece of writing.
The writing is lovely. The voice is lovely. But there's nothing literarily experimental or anything out of the box about this book. Right?
I sort of argue. I don't believe in any distinction anyway. I don't believe there's such thing as literary versus non-literary. I just don't. But it's fiction, yeah, and that's it.
But
and
as a concept, it's a thing.
But yes, if you'd argue the concept being that literary is something that, is experimental to a degree. It doesn't have to be structurally experimental, but and it's something that,
I guess focuses more on craft aspects
is not about plot, is about theme and character. That's often what is, you know, it's not about telling a propulsive story. It's about telling a very intimate character-based story that will have, between the lines, some sort of thematic driver, maybe multiple thematic drivers.
Yeah, possibly.
That aren't always obvious to the reader. That's literary, where you have to work for your dinner. So. That's literary, which I think is bullshit. I've never agreed with that. I still don't agree with it, and I read lots of scare quotes literary fiction.
Yeah, but I think that is the... I think that is the perception. And look, I think there is some merit in it in distinguishing, and not by genre, not genre, but I think there is some merit in distinguishing types of fiction between ones that are very much, was the word you use, propulsive?
Yeah.
Fiction that doesn't rely on the reader having to do a whole heap of cognitive work to decode the thing that they're reading, right? And that's not a criticism. That is a type of writing. And it's very story based. The prose tends to be very accessible, very clear, and pushes you through the story. And that's a type of fiction. But that can happen in genre fiction. It can happen in mainstream fiction. It's just a type of writing. And then there is another type of writing, which I guess is what people talk about when they say literary. Not that everything which is called literary fiction is that, but that where there is more concentration on craft aspects such as structure and theme and style, and it requires a more active way of reading the book. And it's not necessarily about here's the plot from A to B, but there's something else there.
I hear you. I hear what you're saying.
And I think when people say, okay, well, this is literary horror or this is literary SF, they mean that in this particular book, which content-wise sits within a genre, there's more attention being paid to aspects of craft than might otherwise be expected.
But there's nothing here, and I'm sorry to bring up his name, but there's nothing here that Stephen King wasn't doing in the 1980s.
It reminded me very much of a Stephen King
book. It reminded me extremely. In fact, I was constantly being reminded. Because he does the things that King does.
It's King meets Lovecraft is what it is.
He does the thing that King does, which is he's got
and King
the characters.
King has met Lovecraft, so. In terms of his writing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I thought King had somehow travelled back in time.
No.
Stephen King had somehow, hello, HB, how's it going?
No, I just meant like some of his works have Lovecraft.
So it has
aspects.
Some of those Stephen King cliches, which is not even pure to Stephen
even
King.
Even the character, even the voice of it, it's that, you know, the old man, often the lonely person. It reminds me a lot of the character in Insomnia, actually.
Yes, very good. Yeah. So it has the character has a dream that's relevant to the mystical thing going on. It has the whole, I wrote down notes of each. Maybe less King or maybe not. It's got that whole thing that just drives me up the fucking wall now of self-awareness. The character thinks they're in a fiction. As in, if this was a movie.
If this was a movie.
Oh, da-da-da-da-da. And I just, fuck off.
It also did remind me that the two King, because it did from almost from the start, it really did remind me of a lot of Stephen King's writing.
It does that foreshadowing thing that King does.
Yes.
So it already sets up a whole lot of stuff in the very first, which is fine. I'm not.
Yeah. But I think what we're both saying is this isn't something that's. Yeah. This feels like it sits squarely at the core of horror.
You know, this. Yes. Yeah. This is a core horror. This is the bar.
Because it reminded me a lot.
Things should be above this.
Yeah, it reminded
this
me a lot of Insomnia and Bag of Bones. They were the two King books that I thought, wow, this is really. Yeah, not a riff off those books, but just in terms of the voice, the type of character choice.
King has dealt with grief.
The themes that
King has dealt with grief
of,
and often a man's grief when a woman dies, quite a lot in his fiction.
Yeah.
And this is what this book does. But this is not the idea that this is transcendent. Is just does my head in because this is the bar.
It is. This is a core horror.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
It's a good book.
But I'm tired.
It's well written, but it's core horror. There's nothing. As I said, there's nothing out of the box about the fisherman and even the structure of it. I mean, the whole story within a story is a very traditional structure that horror fiction in particular, I mean, other fiction uses it, of course, but horror fiction in particular has a very long tradition of using this type of a structure where you'll have a frame story and either the character telling the frame story will meet someone who gives them another story in the middle of it or they might even tell another. So the nested story thing is itself a very core structure that horror fiction uses. And I mean, and Langan uses that to really good effect. He captures the whole, the past pushing into the present and all of that. He does that really well. And the core story I actually liked better than the frame story.
See, I'm the opposite.
I really like.
I like the frame story more than the core story. I actually wish this had been a realist novel about two men dealing with grief.
With grief, yeah.
And that's the problem that I have with the book. Ultimately, you have this frame story, and I really like the character. Yeah. I was sympathetic to him.
Yeah.
Engaged with him. Yeah. Okay. It's a man's grief about a death of a wife, and that, and it's been done a million times before. But I enjoyed that. And then they get to this. Eatery. Bar and grill or whatever it is, and they get told this story about the fisherman or the fisher. And at that point, the theme just stops. That whole idea of grief just comes to a crashing abrupt.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does.
You've still got all of that in that caught in that middle story.
No, it becomes just a horror story that is about the origin story of what's going on for the rest of the book.
It is, but all of the things that happen in that middle story are centered around grief. Like, it's the same thing. It's grief and loss propels the entire thing.
Yes,
like,
okay,
it wouldn't
yes.
have happened if the wife hadn't died. Of the patriarch in that town, then he wouldn't have had the guest to manipulate him. And then when the reservoir workers
Can I defend myself?
It's all about what you unleash when you try to catch what you've lost.
You're right.
Yeah.
I'm wrong. I agree. It's because there's a distance to the story being told in the centre than the story that's being told at the front.
Because you don't get Lottie, who's the central character in the inner story, telling that story. Lottie's story is put together by...
Think how many removes are in it.
Yeah, like...
It's Lottie to some priest guy. Yeah. Then to
Howard in the diner. Then to, did you
the
notice?
Diner, that's it.
Yeah, Howard from Providence. Lovecraftian.
Okay. Very good.
And that's told to Abe and Dan.
Yes.
So you've got all these removes. And I think, look, when I say I'd preferred the nested story, I didn't prefer it. I preferred what was in it. It's like, it was a really, like, Lottie and the Hungarian woman who kills herself,
the immigrant,
all of that.
I love that whole immigrant thing. I love that it's about the immigrant experience.
Yeah.
Actually, that's what was more pressing to me, was that it's about the immigrant experience versus the grief aspect, which you're right, is there. It does follow through. I apologize.
And the Hungarian woman who kills herself for whatever reason, and then she's brought back as this thing, and you don't know whether, like, is she trying to get her children back because it's the monster wanting to get the children, or is this the remnant of the mother wanting to? Like,
that's,
it's really,
that's great.
And the fact that she's just left, like, no one knows what to do about her. Like, for a week, there's this weird fish zombie woman just popping up there and about town, mildly terrorizing people until she goes a bit too far, and then it's like, okay, now we've got to do something. But, you know, it's like people just don't know. It's like all of the elements of grief where you don't know how to handle things, and you kind of ignore things, you kind of push them away, and at the same time, if you're in the center of something, you will do anything to get back the thing or the person that you've lost. I mean, I think all of that it's wound really well. Langan does a really good job of threading that through the whole story and flagging in this case, the highly supernatural and world-ending consequences of refusing to sit with your grief.
And the Leviathan, the image of the Leviathan.
Yeah.
With the chains. That's beautiful.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, the monster and the scenario at the core of it was really imaginative and quite, you know, it was epic and fathomless. And it was, I appreciated that.
But to me, that middle story, as much as it's all good, it just seems, because you finish that, it actually has quite a climax, you know, the group of men go and they do what they have to do. And then we're back to
Dan and Abe.
And you think, well, this is only going to go one way at that point.
Yeah.
And it goes exactly the way you expect it to go, because where else can it go? I mean, they've just been told this story.
The frame story is extremely, it's core horror. It's extremely traditional horror.
But that's why the beginning is so interesting.
Yeah.
Because it didn't feel like core horror. He foreshadows, you know, this woman with a big mouth and da 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 da, and the story we were told, and all that's foreshadowed. But it's very much a story about a guy who's lost the woman he loves and how that devastated him and how he wasn't able to cope, and then finding friendship with Dan. So this is Abe finding friendship with Dan, and how they joined together through fishing, which I don't give a shit about fishing, but John Langan made it sound really interesting. While sitting at, you know. And the place where they fish is Springvale Road, which is only a few streets up from me.
It's
so
not your Springvale
Road. I know, it's not my Springvale Road. It's very rare to come across an American novel that has a road that's so specific to, like, where I live, around the corner from where I live. That's all.
It's not that road.
Yeah, okay. You get what I'm saying.
Yeah, anyway, I get what you're saying.
Springvale Road.
Yes.
And they're fishing on that road, and it's really, and it's beautiful. And in a sense, I would have liked to have been a novella just about two guys dealing with their grief, no horror element at all, which I know.
I know,
but maybe it's because I'm reading too much literary fiction.
What I found interesting is that, this is another one of those stories about grief. It seems that the main story we like to tell about grief, and I don't know, I suspect it's something to do about the ease of writing such a story, but a lot of them do seem to be about people who are kind of left in isolation, and their whole focus can be their grief, and they might descend into alcoholism or drugs or whatever. But I mean, much more commonly, people need to deal with grief while they're continuing to raise children, continuing to deal with other people in their lives, continuing to work, and this is nothing against like the fisherman itself, but it's just interesting to me, the narratives we like to tell about grief seem to be quite uncomplicated narratives in terms of the lives of the characters. So the grief, the loss that they've suffered is the thing that they're dealing with, and almost nothing else.
Yeah, so there's no kids to complicate the story.
I'm much more interested in people who have
just a larger network of friends and people in their lives who are integral to their lives.
And I'm kind of much more interested in stories which would deal with the messiness of having to cope with a huge loss and still having to go through the world, which is what most people do. Most people who suffer a really significant loss don't have the almost the luxury of wallowing in this type of grief to the extent that we see in The Fisherman and in some other books and movies. You know, they press on through their life and they might be like dying inside, but they're having to go through.
The way Langan gets around that a little bit, or complicates, makes it more messy, is because they're working at IBM.
Yeah.
And there is this whole thing about that it's set in the 80s, I think that's the idea. Because no year is given, but time does move forward. And
yeah, it has to be kind of the 80s because there's no internet, there's no mobile phones, there's no, you know. Although when he's writing this story is quite different.
No, that's right. He's
writing it now.
Now, yes, correct. Yeah. So Dan is the best of the best at IBM, but when he loses his wife and two kids, he of course, loses the plot. And there's this whole thing about how they're now downsizing at IBM at that point, and the whole caring culture is gone. And so there's that obviousness about, keeps his job.
I'm saying because he is in this privileged position, he gets to keep his job. So there's no messiness about, well, what happens if you do that then? And now suddenly you're homeless because you don't have a job and you can't pay your mortgage. And like, again, with many stories of grief, it's a very uncomplicated story.
Why is the argument that's not the story he wrote any more relevant to what you said than what I just said before about how I would have liked it to have been about two blokes fishing?
That's what I said. I said it's not about the fisherman. I'm just saying, like, in the larger scope of things, in the stories that our culture tells about people going through a loss like this, this is generally what we do. And it's interesting to me that this is another example of that, of dealing with grief and just the grief and not having to deal with the messiness of life or the repercussions if you do just focus on your grief and nothing else. Because there aren't repercussions for either of the men by just doing that. I mean, Dan just gets to keep his job.
Yes.
And Abe
keeps
his job and then gets a really healthy severance package at the end, which is years later anyway. You know what I mean? Like, there's no messiness of if you...
Yeah, we don't know what would happen to...
Not having the luxury.
We don't know what would have happened to Dan if he'd have just been allowed to disintegrate without getting involved in a Lovecraftian story. But...
Yeah, so as I said, it's a focus-ish. It's a focus thing. You get from the point of view of an author who wants to tell this, that they want to strip away...
It's a core horror novel. I know. That's the whole
point. And this is what I'm saying. Like,
It's not some sort of literary.
It's part of this.
I mean, it does everything a core horror novel does.
It does.
It ticks all those boxes. And for even people, not me at the moment, it would appear, those are really interesting boxes. Yeah. I just don't. I mean, the whole concept of the frame story, the whole concept of having that central story, and then the second part of that frame story, essentially repeating what we've just been told, but through the eyes now of our main character. And then what he does, though, that is interesting to his credit, and there's a lot to his credit. It sounds like we're shitting on this book, but it's actually a very well-written book.
Really is.
What he does is Langan does, is that he doesn't end it at the point where they go to this other world, this sort of crack in the dimensions where the black water is spilling out. He doesn't end it there. He actually gives Because there's so many years to travel, he gives Abe a coda. A coda, but it's quite a lengthy coda.
Yeah.
You know, where he gets involved with this other family and meets this young girl who also likes to fish. And that's actually beautiful.
Yeah.
That's really nice. And then it's slightly ruined.
But, you know, people love that fucking ending. And it's like, it's just because he stuck his dick in it. Like, seriously, the whole horror of the ending, of the supposed horror of the final ending is like, it's just because he stuck your dick in it. So.
He stuck his dick in it?
Yeah.
So what dick?
His dick.
Whose dick?
Abe's.
Did Abe? What did Abe do? What?
Did you finish the book?
I did. Abe and Dan comes back from the
So Abe had sex with the fish lady who he knew even at the time. He knew it wasn't Marie. Sorry. And he knew it was, and he was telling himself it's not, and yet apparently he's got to stick his dick in it because apparently men have to.
Men have
no control. And that underpins the whole ending.
Yeah.
And we won't say the exact ending, but
I think we could say the exact ending.
Oh, okay. Well, because, exact ending.
You know, I was more, it was more that the idea of the guy coming back from the dead or whatever and during a flood and whatever.
But the cosmic horror that the book ends on is the idea that he's then fathered these monstrous children.
Yeah, which.
And it's like, well, you shouldn't have stuck your dick in it. And it's not like he was tricked. He knew that wasn't his dead wife. Like, he knew it. He said it to himself over and over, but he couldn't.
Yeah, but he. Yeah, no, you're right.
100%. It's like, I was very. It's like when and when that scene happened, really? Really? Is that what we're going to do now?
Is it bad that that just passed over my. It made no impact on me.
No, the end.
I'm struggling to remember it now.
The end didn't make any impact on me.
I only read this book a week ago.
Oh, is that the end? Oh, well, you shouldn't have stuck your dick in it.
What made more impact to me was them fishing.
Yeah.
And the friendship stuff. And what made more. And then the way he has that friendship with the young girl. That had an. Because that's the human stuff.
And it would have been really nice if it whatever, kind of just ended there and said. Because this is the truth. That at some point.
Things move on.
At some point, the grief does end. At some point, there is still life. And that's. You know, that's the thing that everybody who's going through anything like this. Has to hold on to that at some point, and you don't even know when, and you won't notice it when it happens. You only notice it after that. You know, it has tapered. It has,
which is why the coda is so nice.
It was really nice, and then it takes the little turn to like ooh,
as if to monster children. As if to say shit. Don't worry, guys.
It's still a horror novel.
Yeah. And by the way, he's now got monstrous children. Yeah. And which I'd completely, because I know he stuck his dick in it. Yeah.
That scene on the mountain, it's like, oh, really? It's like, I don't know. I just know, you know, like if Jason died and I was all griefy about Jason, which, you know, I would be because he's cool. And then like this fish monster appeared that I knew was a fish monster. And I knew it completely, and he was just there being a fish monster, but still Jason. I wouldn't be going, well, hey, let's just fuck on the mountaintop. Like now. And there was no sense that she would like that she was enthralling him or
No, she was though, because when he turns afterwards, now I'm remembering.
Yeah.
After the fact, he spent his load. He turns around and her true face is shown.
You know, no, look, yeah, no, there's no, like, he knows, but he knows before then.
Yes,
he knows. It's not like he genuinely thinks it's
Marie. To be frank, he's just been told a 200-page story about the exact thing that's about to
occur. He absolutely knows, and he acknowledges that he knew. It's not like he genuinely thought it was Marie and then, oh, my God, he weren't. Like, he knows it's not. He's tricking himself. But he's tricking himself just so he can have sex with the fish lady.
You're right. And again, you know, on reflection, really, he fucks the water nymph.
Yeah.
Then has the temerity to tell Dan, these aren't your kids.
This isn't your wife. Well, he's like, dude, you stuck your dick in it. Yeah. It's like, what are you doing? And as I said, there was no, it's all self-delusion is what it felt to me. There didn't seem to be any intimation other than the fact that she can put a glamour on herself to physically appear like, someone you've lost. There's no intimation that she's in any other way enthralling him. It's all him. It's like, well, I can pretend that's my dead wife and have one more encounter.
They wanted kids.
Yeah, and he's not having sex with her to have kids at the time. He's just having sex with her. It's not like, oh, if I have sex with her, maybe we can still have kids. It's like, no, it's like, there's my dead wife. I'm really aroused now. It's like, it's so weird. It felt like such a ticker box. It would have been so much more interesting if he'd encountered her and knowing like she was his dead wife. I mean, isn't there something more profound you'd want to do with your spouse who's died and who's been dead for years and who you've missed and then let's just have sex.
But he deifies her throughout the whole story. I mean, she is perfection.
Yeah, I know. It's another. Yes, I know.
She's angelic, and therefore,
and so is the wife of Dan. Yes, and it's
and the kids. There's never been an argument. No. There's never been.
And that's what I felt like. I never knew these women ever. I never knew them, and we don't get to know them before they die. Obviously,
and it's the same with
but they
the,
never
it's
felt
the
like
same
people.
With the young girl who dies.
All of them. I never knew. You know,
it's Lottie, you don't get to know because she gets pushed out of the narrative.
It's not the dead woman book.
Well, so I wasn't going to say.
Beautiful dead woman book.
I wasn't going to say.
But it is, and this is one of the core staples that's been in horror for centuries. The beautiful dead women who haunt the men who love them. There's nothing interesting about this book in terms of, like, outside of the box. It's beautifully told. The voice is wonderful. There's some really imaginative scenes, but there is nothing that makes you go, "Wow, this is real. This has struck something in me that hasn't been struck before."
And
you know what I mean?
It feels like stuff. It feels like Pet Sematary. It feels like stuff that was been written in
It felt like a really comfortable read.
Yeah,
like
it reminded
like old
me
slippers.
Of. And I'm pretty sure if I'd read it at the time I read those Stephen King novels, I'd have loved this book.
Yeah. So as I said, I didn't hate it. Like, there was no point in the book where I'm going, oh my God, how many pages left? I mean, it was a fine read, and as I said, I liked it well enough. I wouldn't hunt out any more Langan, I don't think.
I would. I definitely would, because I think he's a really good writer. I think, but
this is the book he spent 12 years on.
Okay, fair enough.
It's like,
But a sign of quality to me is if I can read a book on a plane, because I detest planes.
Right.
And I read most of this on a plane. Okay. So I think...
Is that a low bar?
No. That's actually quite... For me, it's a high bar in terms of whether the book can keep my attention while on a plane. Because usually So, and he does that. He absolutely nails storytelling. I don't think there's any issue there.
Yeah. No, it's... Yeah, I agree.
And it's not his fault. If people have put this up on a pedestal that it doesn't deserve to be on, then that's, you know, it's not John Langan. But yeah, anyway,
it was a comfortable read in terms of how it unfolded and the type of story. But it was beautifully done. Like, you know, it was like really, really expensive UGG boot slippers, not cheap Kmart stuff.
So let's not keep circling the same drain.
But yeah, I'm glad I read it. So I do thank you for the people who nominated and voted for it because
I would definitely
but I feel like
I would definitely search out or read more Langan only. But in the hope
let me know what it's like.
Even if I did just say this is probably core horror is probably not my thing anymore.
Yeah, it's like it edges into weird fiction, which I find really interesting. But I think
what's the difference now?
This is not as weird as weird fiction.
What are you considering to be weird fiction? That's usually Lovecraft. That's where it starts.
That's the origins of it. And that's what I mean. This is very core traditional stuff. I'm much more interested in fiction that does weirder.
Such as?
Does more like stranger things. I would like a lot of what Brian Everson's write.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Is the type of weird fiction that I like. Caitlin R. Kiernan, obviously. Okay, stuff which does... different things either in the on a craft level or in the themes or what characters think or do. It's like I'm happy to read a book like The Fisherman once in a while, but
it's ambiguity you're looking for.
It's
because those authors play in that the ambiguity sandbox.
Neat, you know, black and white ethics. It's all very, and you know, at its like there's a very, very strong line of conservative traditional values in horror, and there always has been. And I'm much more interested in the stuff which questions that and skirts around that and presents something different. And there's some very good authors writing that. Karen Warren is another person who has really good weird fiction. You know, that's the stuff that interests me. I'm still very much interested in the genre. I'm less and less interested in core horror. I'm more interested in what's happening around the fringe and the blending of horror with weird fiction.
And yet you're going to read Owen King and Stephen King's latest novel, aren't you?
No, I'm not going to read
Sleeping Beauties.
I really don't think I am. I've not enjoyed the last few Stephen Kings I've read.
Did you enjoy Revival?
I couldn't finish Revival. When I say couldn't, I mean I didn't. I started it. I put it aside for some reason. I probably had to read a podcast book or something. And I just forgot I'd started it. And I came across it on the bedside table, like underneath the stack of books about a month later and went, oh, yeah, I started that. I can't even really remember what I've read. I'll have to start it again. It's like, nah.
I haven't read Revival. I'll get to it.
I've been really... And it
upsets me.
It feels like a profound loss to me. Yeah, it really does. Yeah. Stephen King has been the one author that I can say I have read my entire adult and a significant portion of my pre-adult life. I probably read my first Stephen King, which was
Skeleton Crew. Skeleton Crew.
I think the first Stephen King that I read, and I probably read that when I was about 9 or 10. So I've been reading Stephen King for almost my entire life, and I genuinely feel sad that I feel like I've disconnected from his work.
And it's your 70th birthday.
Yeah.
And I know this is not a Stephen King podcast,
no.
But it's your fault, John Langan. I can't remember the first King I read. I still think it's It, but that can't be right. Anyway.
I know it was definitely Skeleton Crew for me.
I read that later. But King has gone through phases and stages. You know, there's the time when he was coked out and drunk all the time and when he wrote Tommyknockers and things like that. And he's gone through stages and he's gone through recent changes. And that's why I think it's always interesting to go back to King because where is he at the moment?
Yeah.
I mean, at some point he'll cark it and that'll be the end of that. But but where's he at? You know,
That's the only time it will be the end of that. Correct, that man will be writing until he fucking dies.
Because I never believe he's retiring. And I suppose if you go back to a book like The Fisherman, well, I'm interested to see what Langan does, but given he's not prolific.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'd be interested in reading his collection because that's short fiction. You can dip in and out. It would, I guess, give a better overview of the type of stuff he's interested in writing about.
Well, I'm just saying if this is the epitome of the best of horror fiction at the moment, and it didn't scare me one bit, by the way. There was nothing in it that...
No.
The shambling, weird zombie woman.
Yeah, no, because it was all like we know this stuff. This is not...
This is where horror's still at. Like I said, King moved past this years ago, and
he's kind of gone back though.
Yes, yeah, because he always does. He always circles the drain. He can't help himself. He loves monsters, and he'll always tell you that. But that's the thing. King's been there, gone, and done, come back, and gone again, and come back. Whereas I feel that everyone else is just stuck in this.
Yeah.
In this,
I don't know. It's
all right. Anyway,
it's a bit sad.
So, the second book that was recommended. Was by Light We Knew, or the second book that the patrons voted for, which is not really right because we tossed
a coin. A die on.
A die, that's right, is by Light We Knew, Our Name. I'm saying Anne Valenti.
Yep.
I noticed that Catherine Valente said
Catherine is Valenti.
Valenti.
We've known that forever.
But so I assume Valente is always Valenti, not Valente.
Well, see, Anne Valenti doesn't have an accent on the E either.
So
we're just going to say Valenti.
Okay.
And if Anne wants to correct us and say, no, I'm Valente, damn that, Catherine.
So this collection is certainly more in my wheelhouse than The Fisherman is.
I really like this book. I thought, and it possibly it was just my frame of mind reading it, it was possibly a little long as a collection.
Really?
Yeah. Because
it's 13 stories. It's not. It's about the normal size.
But I think, and maybe then it was just that. I mean, all the stories
they're dense
tonally and thematically. They're telling you the same sort of stuff from different angles and different.
But there's stories that need to be unpacked, and that sometimes tires you out when you've.
But also, they were all the stories about loss and growing up and going through changes and like thematically they're all, which is good for a collection. But that's possibly why, to me, it felt a little long. If there'd been some differently toned.
But I think
stories
is.
In there, maybe. I don't
think
know.
There is.
But it could have also just been me. I've had a month. But I really liked it. And I think Valenti's writing style is masterful. I mean, she's just, like her word choices are always just perfect in terms of the, you know, the metaphor she chooses to describe something, or just the adjectives or verbs that she uses. There's just such a freshness about the way she writes.
And I found at least two or three of these stories just devastated me. And I think that's why it might have felt long. I don't know. Well, it didn't feel long to me, but it's because there are stories here that just the final story in the collection about the octopuses, octopi.
Oh, is that the final one? I thought final one was about the kids and the ghost they may have summoned.
No, that's the second last.
I'm not great at remembering orders. You're right. No, it is the last one. So mollusk, membrane, human heart.
That is just an...
it was gutting.
How dare they put that last?
I know.
Don't put that last. Don't leave me with that.
I know. It's like, no.
I never gave a shit about octopus before this story.
I like octopus.
See, I never cared. Mm. And then I was in tears at the end. I was. It's
a horrible, horrible, horrible story. Like, it's really awful.
I mean, horrible as in, like, what it does to you.
Yeah, no. Content-wise, it's awful. It's
Would you
so
like to explain
awful.
It?
So, it's a, well...
It's a couple who...
No, actually, like, the thing about Valenti's stories is you can give a one or two sentence description of the story and it will tell you nothing about the story. Because all, like, what makes her stories are the depth of the emotion and the multiple subtextual things running through stories. But Mollusk Membrane is ostensibly, it's about a guy who works in a laboratory.
Yep.
And his boss is... wanting to research the origins or the chemical mechanisms of love.
Yep.
And
stop divorces ever happening again.
Yes, stop divorce ever happening again. Because if we understand love, if we understand the chemical mechanisms of love, then we can match people perfectly and everyone will always love the person they married and there'll never be, never be pain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, to do this, well, he doesn't have to. He's just a lazy, cheap ass. Bastard. He's experimenting on the brains of young octopus. And he's doing it illegally without anesthetic because he doesn't think octopuses can feel pain. Because it doesn't like, in the story, there didn't seem to be any indication that he couldn't use anesthetic.
Yeah.
It's just that was an extra step and more money. And so, we're just going
to
do this.
But he knows it's illegal because it's all happening
It is illegal. It's illegal not to inhumanely treat. And because there is movement in the scientific community over the last couple of years to, I don't know whether it's a federal thing or just some state things in the US, but there has been legislation passed which does prohibit certain types of experimentation on octopus because they're fascinating creatures. That's not why you can't experiment on them, but they have different neural centers throughout their whole bodies. So it's like, it's, the way you can treat them is different from the way you can treat mammals and other organisms in the sense of causing them pain and so on. So it is based on actual legislation that does exist in various countries.
And in amongst
countries.
All this, we have Walter.
And Walter's the person who works in the lab
who's guilt-ridden.
Decides he can't do this anymore.
And it's...
Because he grows really attached to the baby octopus as they're growing up.
Yeah, and he saves
one.
And
he knows what's going to happen and he
He in saves one and puts it in a nearby duck pond or it's in his backyard and it just goes from there.
Yeah, and he eventually tries to save all of them.
And it's partly about a couple who can't have kids.
Yeah.
And it's partly about animal torture or animal vivisection and all that sort of thing. And it's just a gut punch.
Yeah, it really is. And a lot of the stories are actually.
I mean, the one about I'll give you the
Title. Valenti doesn't bother to hold your hand at all in her collection. It's just like, here you go. Feel it. Feel everything. I will give you no comfort.
So the one about the young boy or the young man who's wanting to somehow cure his mother of breast cancer.
Oh, with his singing.
With his singing.
Because he, like, there's a story that she told him.
Yeah, that she told him and he believes that he can make that come true.
Yeah, I don't think he really believes
that. No, he doesn't. But that's the beauty of it. Because
that's his little...
I'm reading that story, I'm thinking, where's this going to go?
Yeah, it doesn't go anywhere.
How? Well, is it's either going to be overly sentimental or it is going to have some cure or magic fix to it, or no. And that's the thing about Valentina. Yeah. She doesn't take you where you think it's going to go. She finds that perfect end spot, which might be not a pure resolution. As you said, it might leave threads, but it just feels right, and it feels and emotionally satisfying.
She finds.
I can't even express it.
In all of her stories, she manages to find the balance between, explaining what is happening in the story and what the characters are feeling and why they might be doing things, and leaving a lot of that open, but still having a satisfying end to a story, which is really hard to do. It is really hard to do. And I read one of my books I had to read from a PhD. I read a collection the other day, and it's just like, oh God, because the balance was so off. Like the notes of ambiguity, the notes of, I'm not going to end this and tell you what's happening. It was so out of balance. It's like almost none of the stories were satisfying. Almost every single story I turned the page to go, oh, that was the end. Like it was, oh God. Anyway.
I never had that problem with this book.
No. Stories. This book, like all of the stories, they're so well crafted. As I said, she has a really deft touch with language.
What was one of your favourites? I've given you two of mine.
Oh, gee. As you know, I'm terrible with titles. I love the one about the bears.
The Amelia Earhart one.
The Amelia Earhart one, yes.
See, that's the only one that
did nothing for me. I love that.
I knew you'd love that one too.
I love the one. It's funny because
the argument that Amelia Earhart is actually a werewolf?
No. It's just that Earhart was... To the girls, and I think to their mothers in the story, because Amelia Earhart's disappearance does seem to hit the mothers rather hard too. I think Amelia Earhart was, and like in reality, Amelia Earhart was a symbol of what you could do. Like even as a woman, even back then, here was a woman flying solo around the globe.
I got that bit. I didn't get why.
Like it was this idea, this illustration of what you could do instead of what you couldn't, and given something that you didn't think was possible, what's that? I don't love the phrase, but if you can't be it, if you can't see it, kind of thing. But just so the girls and how they feel constrained about their own lives and their own bodies and their mothers, watching their mothers' lives and seeing how their mothers are constrained, and then seeing this other woman who can literally take flight and leave all that shit and do stuff on her own, and that's why it's so heartbreaking for them when she fails.
Sometimes my brain gets trapped by the genre element, which is either a metaphor in this instance or is literal, which is that they turn into bears.
Yes, they're werebears.
They're werebears, and that sometimes traps me and I can't.
Yeah, no, I just think
the trees from the
The Amelia Earhart was just this, and I mean, consider like how amazing that would have been, like how amazing, like to like as a young girl and. All of aeronautics has been men and men doing stuff and you know, not much has changed. And like, how amazing is it to go, oh my God, a woman can do that. Like a woman can do that. Yeah. Maybe I could fly around the world one day. Like just the idea, the opening that creates in your psyche. And that's what the story is about. So at the time when, and I think like in this story, the earth sign stuff is all, I think that tracks pretty closely to, you know, puberty and growing up and losing the freedom that you often have as a young female child. And then suddenly, as you're growing up, suddenly you're a girl and then you're a woman and you get more constricted in who you're allowed to be and what you're allowed to do and how you can dress and how you can move. And that's, I think, very much what the bears are doing in this story. And then it's threaded through with this, the whole story is this letter to Amelia Earhart, and it's beautiful. And what there's the first of, I think, three stories that are told in plural first person. And it's, I'm sure other people have done it, but I don't remember.
The other story that you're about to discuss, Until Our Shadows Claim Us, does
yes,
it as well.
Which is brutal. Oh. It's, Yeah.
It's very hard to say what's my favourite story in this book, but that one.
Yeah. But the plural for first person, where there is a narrator and there is a single narrator, each of those three stories has a single narrator, and you know that through cues in the text with the what's the one you just said the name of? In the Shadows.
Until Our Shadows Claim.
Yeah. We know because all the other girls at some point are given names and the one who's telling the story isn't because, you know. So you have a single narrator. It's not a plural narrator, but it's told in plural first person. So it's all we. And there's just this beautiful encompassing voice. There is the person telling the story on behalf of herself or I think possibly himself in the case of the one about the children who may or may not have summoned a vengeful spirit. I wasn't
clear on the gender for that one.
Yeah, I couldn't tell the gender. But certainly in the Dear Amelia and the Shadow story, they're both female narrators, but they're speaking on behalf of their group of friends who are in the same situation.
Yep.
So the stories are we, you know, we felt this, we did this, we thought this, we... And it's a beautiful, beautiful voice. And I've been thinking about it ever since I read this collection because it's probably like Anne Valenti's probably not the only person who's written stories in that that point of view, but it's the first that it's kind of struck me and that I've remembered. And I think it's such an inclusive story, an inclusive point of view, and it's a way of telling a really intimate, like you get the intimacy you have from a first person account. But it's something that makes the story bigger than the person telling it. And it also puts the other people in the story on the level of the narrator. So this is not someone telling my story about me and my friends. And here's my story, but my friends are also in it. It's like, this is our story.
Yep.
I've been elected, nominated, chose myself, whatever, to tell you this story. But it is our story, and everybody is in this story is on an equal level in terms of how important they are to the story and how the events of this story affected them. And it's just, like I said, she does it three times, and each time it is beautiful. It's such a beautiful, beautiful voice. I think I want to think how I might use it one day. It's a gorgeous voice.
So talk about the...
Which one?
The serial killer one.
Oh, yeah. So this is a group of kids who... play like a game of, I don't know, Bloody Mary or, you know, all those things you do when you say a monster's name three times or whatever, or do some kind of ceremonial thing and it's going to call forth a monster in the mirror or from somewhere. It's like urban myth. It's everywhere. You know those stories. Yeah. So they do something here. And the person or the monster / psychopath that they are kind of summoning forth was a kidnapper and I think molester of children. Yep. And so they do this when they're in primary school in a cubby at the school or something. And it's all kind of a joke, but also scary as these games are. And then children start to disappear. And they start to disappear at the same time that there's some
natural disaster
in the world.
Or some disaster.
Some disaster in the world.
So it starts with the Challenger exploding.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it starts with the Challenger, which reminded me...
Chernobyl is another one and yeah.
Yeah, you're right. They're mostly not natural disasters, are they? They're mostly man-made.
Yep.
Things, but they coincide with that, and that I don't. It's never fully articulated, and I'm not even quite sure I can articulate the connection between those, except that it's the big sort of disaster that happens, which affects everybody. I mean, the Challenger disaster. Yep. Like I remember that when I was a kid.
I do too.
Right, I remember that very. I can still picture the footage from the television. I mean, I remember that. And, you know, kids in America were in school. They were watching the live. They watched it live.
That was the first time when I read that.
Yeah.
That the teacher just turns the TV off.
Yeah.
It was the first time I realised, yeah, shit, they would have just been sitting there.
They were just sitting there watching it live because it was a thing. It never happened before. They'd never had, why, you don't think that it's going to, and it was a big thing. And there was a teacher, there was a female teacher on the Challenger, which is why a lot of the, So it takes this event, and you'd think that pairing that might diminish one or the other, but instead it amplifies both.
And that's the point, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't know how it does it. Like, why does it do that? Like, why do you pair a missing child with the Challenger disaster or Chernobyl, and neither one is diminished, but instead both are made bigger.
Yeah.
Like it's quite I love that fucking story. But yeah, I don't think there is a dud story in this whole collection. And do you know what story I really, it wasn't one of my favourites, but I really appreciated Minivan.
Is that the rape?
Yeah.
Sorry, and I don't mean to say the rape story, but
no, but that's it, right? Because it's one of the very few stories. In fact, I don't even think I can think of another one that's written from the point of view of the male partner,
yes,
of someone who's been raped, and it starts off being about him, like how he feels,
yep,
and how he feels sort of
and he wants to go to a therapist
and like he can't help and yep, he should have been there and all that kind of usual stuff. And just as you're rolling your eyes, the story does something else, and it's totally about the woman who was raped and how it impacts her. And it's like I said, it's the only one I can think of where it's a male point of view and it's still centered on the victim. And
But why didn't you like it?
No, I did like it.
But you...
Oh, no, it just wasn't one of the, like, you know, like they're all good. There's not a dud story in here. It just wasn't one of my, say, top three. But I really appreciated that and I thought that was really cleverly done.
And they're not all... And there's a mix of, for the use of a better term, genre stories, mm, such as the first one.
Oh, sorry. I'll just say Minivan also has a dig at the reader. Like, it's really clever because, like, so in the story, the girlfriend who was, like, taken into a van, that's why the story's called Minivan, she was abducted into a van and assaulted by multiple men and then kind of left. And she won't tell her partner the details of anything.
And we never get told the details.
Yeah, but as a reader, I found myself also wanting to know the details.
Yep.
And then you get, in the same way he gets this slap in the face realization that that's not for him to know. And if she doesn't want to tell him, it's never his right ever to know, even if he is her boyfriend, even if we are the readers of the story.
Yep.
And it's like, the way Valenti manages to address the reader at the same time she's actually doing stuff to characters is really, like, she's just so good. I would read other, like, anything else.
Well, just on
this
that.
This is her debut collection, though.
It is, but it's, yeah, it, on that she's got a, it's not, she's written a previous novel from memory, but this, her new novel is out in 2019.
Yeah, no, I didn't know there was a previous novel. I thought this was her first book.
I think I'm okay. Right. I should check that.
if there is, I'll dig it out and read it. No, I thought this was her only book, but she has, like, I love words, obviously. I read for words as much as I read for story and so on. And she has this, again, it's all about balance. She has this beautifully balanced way of writing where her word choice is exquisite. She uses really on-point metaphors when she needs to, but she doesn't overuse anything. And the writing isn't, you know, it isn't purple, it isn't saccharine. She doesn't overuse any kind of technique. So I love the writing. And I think she's doing such an imaginative thing.
So
with
in 2016,
stories.
So last year.
Oh, okay.
God, it feels like it was forever ago. her first novel came out, which was Our Hearts Will Burn Us Down, which I now feel the urge to buy.
Yeah, me too.
And her new novel, Utah,
because it's also
called, is out
in 2019. That's a plural first person title, so I'm really interested in that novel.
It came out actually quite late last year, 4th October. So it hasn't even been out for a year yet.
Oh, that, I think I've got that mixed up. I think I thought that was going to be her, like, the next novel that's coming out. So I, anyway, as I just did a really quick search and I've got stuff mixed up in my head. But yeah, so as I said, and I don't know whether it was just me, I've had a wearying month for various things. So it may have just been that, yeah, the collection, because it is, like, it's quite heavy. It's quite,
it is. And
like,
I was saying, there is a mix of genre stories, but the genre stories are never 100% clear, such as the one where the little baby is looking at the...
What is it? Is it the happy baby?
The compassionate baby.
The compassionate baby. That was one
of the other stories that...
That is such an odd little story.
You know, a story you should not be reading coming off a train at 8:45 in the morning.
I was not loving that story. I'm not hating it, but it's just like, oh, okay, yeah, it's a nice little story. And then you get to the very last fucking sentence. It's like, oh. Like, it's just... Yeah, she... just uses words as these emotional fucking weapons against the reader. But in a good way. In a good way. And so, yeah, it is like, it's a, emotionally, it's a really heavy collection. And maybe that's why, maybe if I hadn't read everything, like, all at once. I read it over like a day or two, and maybe I shouldn't have. I maybe should have allowed a bit of room to breathe.
This really is a collection that does not pay to read all at once. I actually highlighted that last section.
There you go.
That's how much it affected me. Yeah. Can I read it out?
Sure.
I don't know if it will work out of context.
No, I think it will. I think it's a really good.
So you got to understand that a father mother situation.
Yep.
Little baby, the
brand new baby
who is a precocious little toddler. Little baby, sorry.
And seems to be emotionally affected,
yes.
Hyper emotionally affected.
Yes, so
for instance, at one point where the father's trying to tell their doctor, trying to explain to the doctor about the baby and why the baby is always, he just rips up a pamphlet in front of the baby, and the baby bursts into tears because that was sad about ripping up the pamphlet. Like, the baby is so over invested emotionally in everything. They almost can't take the baby anywhere, because anything happens, someone drops an apple on the sidewalk, tears. Someone, you know, like, just, yeah, like the baby's empathy gland is hyper developed.
So the baby notices a flower out in the as you do, out in the yard.
A weird flower.
And spends a lot of time just grinning at this flower.
Yeah. Just lying on the grass. That's where the baby's happy.
Correct.
The baby spends a lot of time in the backyard lying down, looking at this flower and giggling.
And it's fine when the baby's first word is, the second one is Rufus, but the first word.
It's a name. Yeah.
It's not fine, but they're sort of going, yeah, all right.
It's a bit weird.
It's slightly weird, and why obsessed? And then the father, Jared, I think his name is, starts seeing something flashing around the flower.
Yeah, you can't quite see it, but we get the impression it's like a fairy or something.
Yeah, but each time that thing flashes, that's when the baby goes, oh, name.
The name.
And then the second time when the baby goes, oh, and Rufus.
Yes, and
So there's now two of these. The father just fucking loses it. He goes, no, I can't accept this anymore. Yes, my baby's happy and seems to be, but there's something going wrong here.
Yeah, there's something weird.
Rips the flower, and this is spoiling the story, but rips the flower out of the grass. And the baby.
Did you gasp?
Yes.
I'm reading it and I just went,
I said, no,
how did you
no,
do that?
No, because you know it's going to happen. No.
I actually like thought in my head immediately, it's like, put it back in.
That's right. And the baby talking, you know.
Hysterical.
And it all leads, she picks the baby up and walks away back into the house. His wails as deep and desolate as foghorn blasts.
Yeah.
I mean, you just, it's there, that image.
Yeah.
Explodes in your mind. Then the last couple of sentences are, but when he looks down, this is the father, but when he looks down at the flower lying askew in the grass like carnage, he wonders if this is true, if it were ever true, and if the baby will remember this at all once he's grown, with no flower to recall and only a world of sadness before him, its sorrows to keep like gemstones to enfold in the pockets of his small, vast heart.
Oh, God. And Valenti, what have you done to us? No, it is a really good collection.
This idea that when we're children, that we're innocent, and that happiness, just to find any source of happiness, is something.
But
you're tearing up.
I am tearing up.
Oh my God! just to have any sort of happiness, because we know what's, because as adults we know what's going to happen next.
But also, I think it does. Like, obviously, this is an extreme representation in the story, but it also shows that like the depth of empathy that children, once they develop empathy, because, you know, some, you know, really small children can be sadistic little fuckers. Well, not sadistic, they just don't understand.
Yes.
But once they develop empathy, small children tend to be really empathetic and will get deeply upset if they see another person upset, or if they think something's been hurt. And at some point, for our own self-preservation, we kind of put a lid on a lot of that, because you can't get through the world as an adult if you react like the compassionate baby every time someone is hurt or suffering or
and the
sad.
Tragedy that the baby will be, because this happens at a young age, won't be able to recall that one moment of pureness, of pure happiness. It's just fucking.
Yeah.
It's just a metaphor for all of us. It's
yeah, no, it's a as I said, until the last couple of sentences, it was like, I was enjoying the story. It was clever. It's like, oh, there's fairies in the flower. Because it's not a, it's one of the more lighter hearted stories in the collection until that last paragraph. Until the final scene where the father rips up the flower and that whole
it's
thing happens.
It's that scene. It's not just the last paragraph.
No, it's the last scene. Until that scene, it's actually quite a light hearted story. Even the way of the baby, it's related like in a joking way. Yeah. So it is like compared to the tone of most of the other stories in the collection, this is a lighter one.
Well, no, the first story in the collection actually sets you up for a fall because that's this one's quirky until then.
Yeah.
But if you look at Latchkey actually, which I love too.
Latchkey's lovely.
But Latchkey's actually quite a nice story.
See, I would regard this collection as.
But it sets you up because you think, oh, okay, so it's all going to be a bit quirky and Twee's not the night is a majority of these days, but it's going to be all a bit quirky.
Shimon-esque.
Shimon-esque, yes, and a bit strange and off center, you know. And no, this is just an example of the sort of work she does. But fuck me, she could do a brilliant story on going off to war or on this idea of a son who doesn't know his place, feels lost, his brother has died, doesn't really connect with his parents.
Yeah.
Well, a mimetic story, a very real down-to-earth story that has there's no genre. Yeah. It's not quirky. It's just about families and losing a child and then one wanting to go off to Vietnam or I think it's Vietnam and the horror of that. And just so powerful.
Yeah.
And compare that to Latchkey, which is about kids who, when they get to a certain age, they have a magic thing happens to them.
Like it's, and yet all of the stories, despite the fact that there is this mix of fantastical, non-realist stuff, and then stories which are very real, they all fit together. All fit together beautifully. Yes. There's nothing that feels like, oh, that doesn't quite belong in this collection. If anything, as I say, it's like quite emotionally laden.
Latchkey just set me up though.
Yeah, it's a really good story to start with.
No, but it set me up for thinking differently to what this collection was going to do. Yeah. I thought it was going to be a bunch of quirky little oddities, but it's not that at all.
No. It's a really, I was just going to say before, it's like, I just thought then, like, can you imagine if Anne Valenti got given the brief to write The Fisherman? Like, it would be such a different book. I bet she wouldn't be sticking her dick in it either. It's like, I want to read that book. I want to read The Fisherman by Anne Valenti. Sorry, John Langan. But just like, that's what I'm saying, it's not just content.
Although you can get away with more in short fiction. I mean, you can sustain that. And to be fair to John Langan, I mean, I've not read his short fiction either. So maybe he does something in the same vague boat that. And that's why we have to read her novel and see if it's any good.
Yes, now I'd like to read the novel. Now that I know it is actually out, I might grab that and put that on the Kindle.
So, not disappointed with our patrons.
No, not at all. And
Introduce me to a writer who I will now read all her work.
I would also really like to thank my lucky D6.
Because that brought up the Valenti, so.
Because without that role, we wouldn't have read the Valenti.
We're not going to name who chose what, are we?
No, I haven't looked that up.
No,
but right. You know who you are. So thank you for the two people who nominated it, and thank you for the people who voted for them, and thank you to my D6.
Yes, and I'm not... and. Last year was a little bit bit more uneven. The Fisherman, I don't regret reading.
I'm
quite happy to add John Langan to a list of writers that I will keep.
Let me know what his short collection is like, because I'm always happy to read some short fiction more than commit to another novel, which is ridiculous because a book of short fiction is the same fucking length. So anyway, but there you go.
Yeah. So. I think well done to the patrons.
Yes, and thank you. Thank you again, because I definitely found an author who I love. Oh, I've got two Valentis now.
Yeah.
That's weird, isn't it? Ooh.
They're very different, though.
They're very, very different.
But both excellent writers.
Yes, absolutely.
Both know how to use words.
Absolutely.
That's quite important as a writer.
That is quite important.
So, next episode.
What are we doing next month? What is next month?
Next month is, you've written here, horror dark novels.
Horror slash dark novels.
Okay, I've got to add the slash, do I? Horror slash dark novels.
Because it's October.
Yes.
And October has Halloween in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yes.
And therefore every
day. I am so fascinated what you think of White Tears by Hari Kunzru, yep. Kunzru, which is one of them. And I've actually read both these books already. Okay. So I'm going to have to, especially the second one, Confessions by Kanei Minato, which was, from memory, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, was nominated for a Shirley Jackson a couple of years back.
Yeah, and that's like, it's one that's been on my radar for a while. And you suggested White Tears, and I went, oh, I'll find another horror novel that I've been meaning to read by not one of the usual suspect authors. And yeah, so that one. It sounds interesting. Sounds very interesting. So
yes. So you haven't read either. So nope. You'll be fresh as a daisy on both of them, whereas I'll be going, oh, well, I didn't reread them, so.
I'm going to try.
No, with Confessions, I'm not going to reread it, but I'm going to have to.
Skim it.
Yeah. Okay, so feedback to. Yeah, thank you, Ian. You were allowed to. I've given you permission now to mention the feedback. You could comment at the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com.
I didn't even say anything.
It's the way you looked at me. Yep. That's it. We're at feedback time. Or the. Where you can send it. writerandcritic.podbean.com, email writerandcritic@gmail.com, writerandcritic on Twitter, or sponsor us on Patreon if you can.
Yes. And I'm looking forward to next month.
You weren't looking forward to this month? You should look forward
God's
to
sake.
Every month.
Can you not like put words in my mouth?
No, I'm not. I'm is that gaslighting what I just did?
No.
Oh. I'm trying to
this
come up
with. It's being really fucking irritating.
Well, that's default for me. But I'm trying to, you know, ramp it up to do different types of irritating. It's all a bit bland if it's just the same. Wow. Do you want to end it here?
I don't think I'm allowed to look at you, right?
I am also looking forward to next month as well. Thanks, Kirsten.
Sometimes I hate you. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
'Cause you need to make your own award and then you'll always know what the shortlist is. Always.
I have thought about that.
You could do the Mond Award.
I should and give 500
the Mond Prize.
Give $500 to the winner.
And what would your criteria be?
Just shit I like.